Welcome to the New Monastics Podcast, where we'll be discussing all aspects of the contemplative life and interspirituality in the context of modernity. On each episode, we will choose a topic to explore with one of today's leading teachers or thinkers. The New Monastics Podcast is a project of Charis Foundation for New Monasticism and Interspirituality, which is dedicated to the emergence of a newly conceived contemplative life of embodied spirituality and sacred activism. Welcome to the New Monastics Podcast. I'm Natanael, co-founder of Charis Foundation and dialogue partner for our guests.
And I'm Daniel, the host for the show. Today we have Lily Fangs, a hip-hop artist known for her versatility and range, well known in the festival scene for her freestyling abilities and personable performances. Welcome, Lily.
Hi, thank you.
Lily, we were together in February at Heartfire Festival, and I think we started chatting toward the end about the possibility of sitting down to talk about the connections between art and spirituality. And I thought, well, we could sit down in a coffee shop, but we could also record a podcast. And so I'm excited to do that. And I think you might have mentioned it to me, because I think during one performance, I got on the edge of the stage and was having a conversation about artistic process. You know, I'm also a visual artist. And, you know, so where does the music come from? Where does the art come from? And where does the spirituality come from? You know, the things that emerge and arise out of us, it may be, you know, from the same place. And so I think that's a great conversation for us to have. And so we wanted to have you on and talk about where your music is rooted in your spirituality, how your spirituality connects to your music, and kind of how you conceive of those connections. So, you know, whatever you have to say about that, we'd love to start off the conversation that way. The simple thing.
Well, thank you guys, for starters, for having me. It is cool that we can just be together inside of a computer moment. And real life tea as well will soon occur. But I do appreciate this topic. I think it can have legs in many, many directions. And yeah, I remember hearing you. I don't know what you heard. But you speaking to the channel, just like the OG relation with spirit. I mean, because you've shared many lectures, there's a few I've caught, but that I think lit my light bulb up. I think it's always a good meter for me personally. I can tell how I am doing in my health by how accessible that conversation is. You know, when I'm shut down, when my heart's shut down, when I'm kind of collapsed in density, or I'm in a question with my relationship with God, spirit, or I'm in confusion, which is personally fine. Cool shit comes from confusion, and confusion is okay. And it's always just a great gauge, because art for me is deeply informed by my spiritual journey, including the dark nights of the soul, including the question marks, including the breakthroughs, break opens, epiphanies, or the peace. I love the peace. I love the soothing space of just a gentle relation with it all. But from all these different fields, the chaotic ones or the like refuge spaces, I find in a devotional practice, like whatever it be, it's all welcomed. So making an art practice that's big enough to welcome it all, and then making a performance practice, why my offerings become so freestyle based, is because I think it's like it's different every time. We can have the same stories or the same songs that we plan to bring to the offering, and then it's influenced by the field. And for me, physics is spirituality, and the collective field and the way it informs me, and that feedback loop is super dope to just meet what's there. And it's a practice of meeting what's there. That's my meditation practice, at least. And so it just extrapolates into either the writing or the recording or the performance. It's like, mm-hmm. What's here? And let's try and be with it without judgment. Obviously, every time that doesn't work, because the ego still has the microphone sometimes. But yeah, what were you saying? Each time the story can come out different than planned, or
there's something about like spiritual practice that can happen when you're alone. But then some of us are doing spirituality in public. And I wonder if there's a similarity between the kind of authentic performance that an artist is in public and an authentic spiritual talk, because you're in relationship with the people present. So it's not just me alone in my process. If that were the case, there'd be nothing to say at all. Like, I'm talking to people or I'm not talking at all. But when I'm talking to people, then the way their ears are tuned and the way they're facing me or not facing me impacts what I'm going to say. So I think where I'm going is, like, there's a connection between public ritual and authentic public performance, where you have to be alive to the moment and the container, and the people are part of that container. And I don't know exactly how it works. I think it's maybe part of the same sort of technology, though. Like, the container is shaping what comes forth. Maybe you had an idea of what you were going to do. Maybe you had a set list. You know, that's my story that I might be telling, but I might tell it different depending on the vibe of the group that's present. So there's something about the living speaking, living performance, living ritual that can't be formalized to the degree where it's performative. It has to be a living thing. You know, that's where the art is. It's in the livingness, not just in hitting every note exactly the way it's supposed to be. Maybe that doesn't really exist. Maybe that's the lie and not art at all. You know, maybe that's just recording. So I don't know. There's something for me that is almost the same, because, you know, in our earliest, you know, even prehistory, way before history, there was not a distinction between art and ritual. They were the same thing. Mm-mm. We've divided them, but maybe they've never been truly divided when both are done authentically.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, and something I appreciate about your performance, Lily, is how live it is. And for me, it feels like it stands in contrast with so much modern artistry from musical performers and hip hop performers, where it is so prepackaged. The set list is set in stone, and it's like, I'm going to start this song, cue fire, play this song, like, cue dancers. Every set is exactly the same. Like, you, a major artist goes on tour, and it's like every show is like a replica, or there's these standard ways they switch it up, but it is very prepackaged, and it's a kind of consumer experience. It's like the artist is creating something for the viewer to consume. And in the freestyle performances, I feel like you always bring in the crowd in one way or another, and it makes it so that performance will never be replicated again. And that feels like it has this kind of quality of spiritual vitality that is often missing from live performance in our culture.
I wonder. I love this topic. I do. I think there's a nutrient for what everyone's seeking. So, like, that packaged plug and play offering has its, everything's got its place, I guess. We're not saying that, but there's certainly something different that goes on when we open up all the space for, I call it the one of ones. I played a show on Saturday night that, just as we're speaking to, was planned a little bit, set list, intentions, and was adapted in the moment to what was there, which was not the fucking plan, you know? And what I love about showing up to the surrender experiment, it's a confrontation of my ego every time, or of my control freak, or just not even a freak. She's not even that freaky. It's like just very controlled, you know? And the industry that we have, and capitalism at large, and all of the correlations to, are fundamentally about control, right? And so most musical offerings, there's also usually a big network of people involved, and people need to know what's the specs on it, what's the time, who's involved, when, payments, and just different overhead infrastructure components. And that's something that comes with scaling. So I know I'm meandering around, but this is just so cool for me to think about, because it's an offering I do, and it's, for the most part, been pretty intimate. I mean, I've played to rooms of upwards of 1,000, but the coolest shit happens when it's under 100. And then now we're talking the quantitative components of metaphysics and like how spirit can move in large spaces. Not that it can't in a field of thousands, like I'm excited to try that, but it's a lot different than me being able to make close eye contact, bring people in and ask them for a word or, you know, four words from everyone to make a song in that moment that is just through me or from me, I don't know, from us, for us. And so when I've been asking myself, how do I scale this? I haven't asked myself that much because I don't care that much. But hypothetically, if I were to scale the performance of the freestyle thing, you know, would it be possible? Because so many people on a team that would be required for scaling, right? You're then working with everyone else's control freak. And if they know you're about to go into an hour of we don't know what's going to happen-ness, you have to get a very particular type of crew on board, because I've worked with sound people. I've worked with people who don't like the unknown. And now we're back to spirituality, which in my understanding is a whole lot of mystery. And so it's like, what is your relationship with mystery? Mm-hmm. And I'm having compassion for myself when I freak out, you know, when I'm in poor relationship with accepting the unknown and mystery. And I have compassion for that part in all of us. And so it's been cool to even work with different band members who are down and not down with improving and freeze. That's a very particular type of artist to work with. Usually they have a jazz background, you know, it's like you get to just be with what is there. And I appreciate you speaking to like that's lacking in the industry. Maybe I think it's lacking in humanity. Mm-hmm. We're like really scared of the unknown. And again, that's not good, bad, right, wrong. It reflects. I think it always reflects in areas, in business, in arts, in education. And like, we get to take a little temperature read of where we're at. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting for me. So I'm known for being spontaneous and going wherever the energy is, you know, with a group of people, and whether I'm a teacher in the classroom, which I am, or I'm giving a public talk, turning to where the energy is. But a lot of where that comes from for me is from being scared. I used to have a public speaking disorder. Like I could not even open my mouth in a group of 3 to 4 people until I was in my late 30s. You know, I wow. wasn't talking at all because I would have panic attacks. And so part of the reason for my spontaneity now is it's been part of a personal challenge. I would try to come up to the moment where I had to speak in public. And I was being, it wasn't like, you know, talk in front of 3 people. You know, by the time I'm coming into my vocation, I'm being asked to speak in front of 30 people. So it's kind of a leap. And so I'd have to build myself up. And I had, you know, various kind of visualizations that I would do, or I would plan my first 3 words or my first 10 words. But over time, I kept trying to back it up, so that I felt confident with nothing, you know, because I didn't think it was true confidence to come in there with a plan. Mm. And so, you know, I still use a bit of a plan, but my mantra was, you belong in this moment. I belong in this moment. And like, I have to believe that that's true. So I don't have to know everything, but I do have to believe that I belong, and whatever I have to give is the thing that might need to be given. Mm. And so the spontaneity was really a personal exercise of like finding true confidence. True confidence is, I belong here. We'll see what needs to happen. And until that became addictive, like that's my joy, you know, really to find something in the moment, not to do a prepackaged performance, but to be fresh every time. Even to use the old material in a fresh way, because that gets really boring for me really quick, you know, if I can't change it. So it's just interesting where it came from for me. I was afraid and didn't want to be afraid anymore. And now, like, the true confidence is to be alive in the moment and not have to be ready in an artificial manner. Mm. So I don't know how it is for you. Where does it come from?
That sounds like a powerful dance with your control freak. Was the control keeping any speech, any talking withheld? That was the first control of just like, I need to stay safe. It doesn't feel safe to publicly speak at all?
Yeah, I was scared that I was invalid somehow, probably. I just wasn't valid.
Which I think going all the way into that feeling, which I dance with every time. At this point, my relationship with it is different. It's precious. It's really precious. It's humbling. It's challenging. It's called imposter syndrome. It's called many things, right, for people. But I just receive it as part of myself. Yeah, that's very scared of being unworthy of the opportunity to hold the space I do. And it's been kind of inverse. I started out, I don't know if it's being from New York or like what attitude download I got that was like entitlement or whatever it was, didn't come up for me as much in the first, I'd say, 3, 4, 5 years of my career. There was a hunger. There was a hunger. Granted, that's also informed by hip hop when you do have a million rhymes in your head, and my things were more pre-written, pre-memorized, pre-rehearsed, and I knew they were dope. I was like hungry to prove. Mm-hmm. There was like a different essence. There was a way different essence when it was this pre-organized offering. It was the equivalent of writing, like putting my heart and soul into a thesis that I was like, everyone's got to read this and everyone's, you know, like this must be received. And I miss that version of me a little bit. I think I got bored of how little space that let in for spirit because it was so ego forward. I think I've been humble that I had a lot of health issues. But something flipped, and that non-preparedness, just like not caring about validity, because there's something bigger going on. There's something that I can't even put a word to. There's something that I'm okay with not understanding. It's pretty humbling. And then there's a necessary prayer before I go in, which often looks something like, may I be protected and use me. You know, use me. I've carved enough space in this vessel to be of service to whatever is necessary in the space. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you show up that way as well. And we all do. Daniel, when you move into the cipher, that's like part of it really is so innocent, playful, like I'm going to be dope. And then a lot of it is like making enough space to be used. And the irony is that's when it's the dopest. It's when something we can't cognitively get too far ahead of. And that's just, you know, hats off to the intelligence that's so larger than us. It's like, what did we just say? Mm-hmm. Those are my favorite moments of like, what just came out? Dope.
You're both speaking to the kind of role or orientation of the artist or speaker, performer, whatever its setting it is, whether it's spiritual teaching or performing music or other kinds of art. But it was actually making me think of the role of the audience and how for a kind of proper co-creation or for this facilitation of spirit-infused art, it kind of requires a certain orientation from the crowd. And I think this is true both for spiritual teachers. Like if teachers have a group of students that are receptive and are hanging on to every word and are trying to mine the depths of what's being said, and there's a certain level of presence that's being offered from the listeners, then that bolsters the teacher. And I've heard Unitunnel speak directly to like, without that, there's almost a lack of true inspiration. You can't really concoct it. And I'm imagining for you also, Lily, that like freestyling by yourself feels a lot different than freestyling to an attentive crowd. Cause I've seen you and there's people that are just like, they're hooked, you know, they're listening and they're offering their presence. And in a way it feels like when that spirit comes through, it's not just a personal spirit, but in a way is a manifestation of the collective field, all of our spirits coming together. And in a way the crowd offers the teacher or the artist, like gives them permission to be that kind of a vessel. And I feel like that's something in performance we don't really talk about that much, how a performance is really co-created between performer and the audience. And it's not necessarily just one way. So I'm curious about both of your experience with that and if that feels resonant.
Yeah, there are times when I start to talk and I feel alone. People aren't with me. And I take responsibility for that moment. Not that I'm responsible for them not being with me, but then it's like, well, I've got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I can't start my talk where I want to start it. I have to start where the people are at and then kind of walk them up to the place where we need to be together in order to like actually have this experience. That's like tuning, you know, you got to get everybody tuned to the right frequency. Mm. It's hard to explain, you know, what that process is. It's just that you feel like it's not happening right now. Mm. And so, okay, let's just go on a little journey together and get to know each other until now this thing can launch. It can take off. And that does happen. And that's always interesting. But it means you have to check out of like commodity mm. time. Because this thing is going to take as long as it takes to get to the right place. and so sometimes that's when your performance or your talk is going to go a little long because people weren't ready for where you wanted to start. And then you're kind of the conductor, you know. You got to move energy without being manipulative. Yeah, because you don't want to do it artificially. So you have to like find out where they're at. You see where the energies are. And then try to get into the place we need to be to talk about this thing. Because there's no point in talking about it if they don't have ears to hear it. So we got to get the ears open. So that's definitely a thing that happens.
That is definitely a thing. Yeah, you exactly how you just shared about it. And not all the time, because my default is a little bit of just refuge. The performative element, that can be between me and God. Mm-hmm. Like I don't, that can be a room full of thousands or one person or zero peoples, but a different variable comes in when the droplets of God, that is everyone's, are there also. And I love how I just felt so related to or relatable that like there's a gear I like flying the spaceship in. And when I get to the base camp and we're not enough there collectively, whether be it through my lack of emceeing and organizing the energy, or, you know, something's going on with the planets and everyone's in all sorts of different life. Everyone's in different life experiences, period. So my job is to use my antennas. I'm learning not overuse them. It can cause a migraine, but I'm like learning how to use my sensitivities to see, all right, where are we at? Where am I at? What's true? What's not manipulative? What's not forceful? What's the isness? And then where does the isness want to go? I have a goal in mind. I have, as I said, a preferable frequency. I've also been present in lots of sorts of populations. And what feels better? The like heart open from jump venue space where everyone is, you know, maybe more sober oriented and prayerful and open and ready to just be in some shanti shanti shit together, like very just there. However, that's not always the most rewarding because I am into the journey. When we're already there from zero point, like that's just cool. Oh, this feels so sweet. This is just, there's ease. But when I can be in a space where maybe nobody knows me or knows what to expect, or we've got lots of different lifestyles and socioeconomic situations going on, and there's not as much receptivity. You know, maybe there's a lot of anger in the field, and me just projecting like choose peace over everything isn't as true. Yeah. That's where I get to tune in to just honesty of the human condition, and that's why I appreciate the vessel of words and of music, because we can traverse many frequencies very quickly. I can speak to many things and I can effort them towards an ultimate return to the heart, but without judgment or attachment, like where we get stuck. Because I'll get stuck here. My shit's very socially commentative and sometimes kind of cynical. And I actually have had trouble really accepting that. I've been on a journey of accepting that's my flavor sometimes. It feels more honest than me doing the peace, peace, one love thing for 2 hours. I have to touch all the different parts of our psyche that get stuck in judgment, in fear, in opinions, in humor. I'd say humor is usually the knife that can cut through everything, or most things. It can be a great unifier. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm in a good place on a journey of a set or performance when I can laugh at myself. At this point, I can do that as the like opening line. I'm just like, we're existing. What the fuck? We're here. Wow. And it really has turned into more of like a circus sideshow comedy freestyle with some musicality, spiritual speech thing. And I don't know what's happening, but it's rapidly transforming my set. And if someone expects, yeah, the same thing every time, just don't call me for that. That's not going to happen.
That's funny. I do a similar thing. Like, I consider myself ridiculous. Like, I'm laughing at myself most of the time, you know. So when I'm kind of making fun of myself while talking, it's fairly authentic. I'm just looking at my own process, and it's funny. And sometimes I just, you know, speak it out loud in front of people. And that works, you know, because people feel very personally involved then. But I think it comes from a deeper place. You know, I was talking about fears before. And I sometimes say that, like, vulnerability is my shield. Mm. The thing that protects me up there is that I'm not afraid to be afraid in front of people. Mm. I'm not afraid to be vulnerable. And so if you are afraid to be vulnerable, then you got something to hide. Mm. And you're going to get unmasked at some point. So I just unmask myself from the beginning. Now that's the shield that keeps me fluid and flexible. Mm-hmm. And what this is bringing up for me, you know, in what you're saying, if we go back to this idea of being prepackaged and everything, there's a certain confidence that comes from knowing exactly what I'm going to say, you know, hitting my marks. I think that's early confidence. That builds confidence. But then there's a level of confidence that comes beyond that, being able to let go. What we seem to be articulating together is that there's something better than that, and it's a kind of a dialogue. Hmm. Being aware and responsive and alive in the moment. And, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because it's clear that there's a kind of spirituality active in your art form. And we don't have to name names of artists, you know, that use spirituality in a very fixed sort of way. Like, I'm going to write about this, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to use the Gayatri mantra and do, you know, they're out there. To me, it doesn't feel very organic. It feels like, you know, a thing, that's somebody's thing to do that. But what we seem to be talking about is dialogue with audience, dialogue with ourselves. If we're in a natural, organic dialogue with spirituality, then that's going to come into your lyrics. It's going to come into your freestyling without it being like, I'm going to prescribe shanti, shanti, shanti to you. It's just, if it comes up, and maybe it comes up in a really interesting fashion. Like, when I last heard you, you did, speaking of dialogue, you did a dialogue with your ego on stage.
Yeah, the Adventures with Ego, the poem.
Yeah. And it was just like, it was a conversation going back and forth. And maybe that's all that this is, like being willing to dialogue and be authentic in a moment, you know, with ourselves, with others, with the energy in a moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where I want us to go, is like, what does that dialogue look like for you between maybe stuff that you're reading or stuff that you're trying to practice, and watching it arise in terms of your art form? And let's acknowledge you have more than one art form. You're a visual artist too, and you got a science background. So there's a lot of complexity in any person that doesn't get to get known.
A lot of dialogues going on.
Right. Especially when you're a public performer, people typecast you into one thing, but we actually know there's a lot going on with you. So what's that internal dialogue look like?
Yeah, I wanted to define dialogue. I still don't know, like, roots of that word, breaking down the etymology of it. Like, I'm present and I heard everything, but I'll get distracted because I am such a word nerd and I love the etymology. And like, sometimes there's like nuggets and codes for us in there and invitations. There's invitations. So a dialogue feels like sending rapid invitations, rapid inquiries. And as you said, yeah, there's a few different things I come from that have invited me into inquiries, many rabbit holes I've traversed and many orientations. I'm seeing like just, yeah, big helix my background's genetics. I don't mean it that way, though. It's like when you get down to the microcosm of nucleotides, like the DNA's got a lot going on. There's a lot that makes up, it's still a little thing, but it's a big thing that informs a bigger thing, that it's like informing and their invitations, and they're actually could go, they go both ways. So epigenetics, more specifically what I studied, what can change in one lifetime with the cross-section of expression or of entheogens, and that's what I was looking at, is like, yeah, what can shift in one lifetime? So this is my first time thinking or saying this stuff out loud. How about in one showtime or in one container? So what can change in all, in everyone's cells, in all cellular material, what new conversations are going on? And just, it's like kind of following a weird breadcrumb trail of the what's here now-ness and relinquishing control over and over and over again. Yeah, and sometimes you can't even hear the invitation. Sometimes I'm a little too in my human dramas to hear the bigger invitation.
Yeah.
And it's okay. that's where the parts that have trained like for being in control or being the master. I think MCs, I think is fascinating, master of ceremonies. When on my pilgrimage as a seeker, I have found that there's like a much larger master of ceremonies than any human will embody. But the command I feel when an MC at least steps up to the task of mastering a ceremony, or they're masterful with the ceremony, which really means, again, letting be what is there and wants to move through each person to be of a healing effort or to just be whatever alchemy is wanting to get down, like that's a ceremonialist. Mm-hmm. And so not everyone is an MC, a master of ceremonies, but yet we take that title pretty quickly in hip hop. I haven't thought about that. And so I don't think I'm still even there yet. But as I said, the ego of entitlement to being there, or the just idea of control, was a lot more intact earlier in my career. And something has softened. Something has been humbled. Something's getting better at listening. And so much of the dialogue is, more than half the dialogue's, obviously I love to talk. I'm rambling. It's a good muscle I got. But the listening skills is something I'm working on, because I think it informs our heart and our ability to even offer anything of value. And it's connected to our kidneys. I just finished a five elements Chinese informed yin yoga teacher training, and it was really dope and well done. And we focused mostly on what poses support different organs, right? And I learned something I guess I knew because of the reflexology in the ear and how it looks like a kidney. But truly what we listen to, and kidneys, like the mass, they're the master organs. They're like, they're top dog in the systemology. And what we listen to, frequencies of what we're listening to, and what kind of conversations we're participating in, what performances or what teachers or what we're receiving, like that goes right to our kidneys. And I'm in a big forgiveness practice with myself, because I've spent a lot of my life listening to like pretty gnarly dubstep or angry hip hop or, you know, angry teachers, even within my life in academia, just like teachers who don't want to listen back and aren't in what I understand education to be, educare, which is to draw out of, mm-hmm. right? Which is to really be in that exchange. And so when I'm just spending, and I have clocked thousands of hours in a classroom with a person who, yeah, maybe isn't interested in listening or is just angry and has an agenda, like it's all good. Again, I'm back to the whole alchemical field of it's all had its purposes. But I do think I've taken in a lot that, I don't know, might have hurt my kidneys a little bit. Why my migraines happen? Why my health is like, the chi is depleted. And so that's a new thought of being choiceful with what we say, with what we eat, that diet, but with our listening diet. And that's a little more nuance. It's a harder to control, so to say. Ears is one thing we can't. I thought it funny you said we got to open up their ears. We got to get to that point. But like it is, the ears technically are the one thing. Like your eyes, you can close. Your mouth, you can close. We can't close our ears really unless we go like la 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 la, like a 5-year old. But so we're always tracking. We're always we're antennas, and just learning how to calibrate or tune, like you were saying.
But maybe that the fact that, you know, we can't stop up the ears, that they're always kind of passively receiving, might be why we don't listen a lot of the time, you know, because like,
you think we're oversaturated?
Yeah. So like our one response might be that we're just not paying attention. Mm. So we can't stop the sound coming in the ears, but we're not necessarily paying attention or awake and aware. Mm. And so when I say the ears aren't open, it's like, it's just a way of saying like that person is not porous to me. They're opaque, you know, because it's one of the first things we learned. Like we don't like being talked at all the time. And so we just check out, tune out. And so that becomes habitual in us. So how do we get back to being porous and open? And then if you're in the position of having to talk to closed ears, it's hard. Like, it doesn't feel good.
Mm. Yeah, you just said tune out, which struck me because you were talking about getting in tune. So that phrase, it never connected for me that is the correct phrase. When people are tuning you out, you are not in the same frequency. You're not in tune with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like our one defense mechanism. It's a necessary skill to have. There's a lot of bullshit, you know, to maybe try and tune out. But because Daniel asked like the nature of that receptivity or non-receptivity and the audience's participation, it's such a cool thing. It's such a cool like live science experiment. It's different every time, and it makes a big difference every time. The homie who I just had out from California as the headliner for a show on Saturday night, he's been a friend for a decade and he's a brilliant poet, and pretty cool to watch his arc and his spiritual path as a like pretty tough young dude, and the content and how it changed. I've known him for 10 years and just his arc with vulnerability work. I mean, long story short, his last song, we ended up all sitting down and he's crying on stage. You know, which like was true, not performative, but you know, just the fact that that's now what his sets are ending with was just this like, okay, and I guess we're all going here together now. And he's a tough, you know, like Bay Area. We both had our like snapbacks on and like a different vibe. It was a Denver City show, and we get paid to cry on stage with together. I'm very happy to play any sort of role in making it feel safe for people to have all sorts of emotions. I think that's ultimately what I'm here for, as I'm a full spectrum being and I've lived very dark realities. And then I've touched and been gifted to have very bright realities with more light and beings that are committed to the light and anchoring some of it. But what I am most committed to is full spectrum experience and letting people know it's all okay.
Yeah. And just on that, I think it's dope how I see this kind of spectrum embodied stylistically also, where you do a lot of switching between singing and sometimes singing really like beautifully and kind of like ethereally. And then you got some like really gritty rapping, even just tonality, like the singing can be a lot higher pitched, and then you get like grumbly in the rap and you're like, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of like barking mm-hmm. at the crowd. And I feel like that really contains the spectrum that you're speaking to. And then, and when Natanael asked about kind of more generally, kind of how does spirituality fit into your life, given that the art is just coming from your life. And so it's clear, in as much as the spirituality is infused in the art, it's clearly infused in your life. And in your response, it sounded like, and please reflect if this feels resonant, but it seems that there's a kind of core orienting aspect of your spirituality, which is a certain kind of truth seeking and search for authenticity. And that connects to a question I wanted to ask you about a connection I see between spirituality and hip hop. There's such a big ethos in hip hop of keeping it real, you know, and that's often distorted. Like keeping it real means, were you really living the street life that you were talking about in your music? You know, and we're not really talking on that level, but that feels like a deep spiritual principle of keeping it real. And in thinking about this, I'm thinking of a couple of different kind of stories where the kind of point of the story is like, do you understand the true meaning behind these words, or do you just know the head knowledge of it? And so much of spirituality coming down to like, is this real for you? Like, are you in an actual relationship with another person, with your own heart, with the universe? Are you able to really keep it real and be real? And I'm kind of just wondering for you what that means in terms of like that ethos as it relates to your life in spirituality of like, what does it mean to keep it real? And how has hip hop culture informed your spirituality?
It's a fire question. Well, I'll start with that last piece. How has hip hop culture informed my spirituality? It's multifold because I'm a borrower of this culture. You know, it's like very much got an origination that is not with people who look like me, and it's given me refuge. You know, I'm from New York, and it was highly filling the air that I breathed, and yet still was something outside of me in a big way, but wildly the closest thing I ever felt to belonging. Mm-hmm. You know, at a really young age, I got all types of hip hop in my headphones. I mean, I'm like a scrawny 6-year-old little girl, and I'm listening to Notorious B.I.G., Give Me the Loot, and memorizing every word because, you know, the sponginess of our brain at those times. And give me loot, I'm a bad boy. You know, like there's some really inappropriate topics. Retrospectively, there's a incarnation component. I was like, yep, I've lived all this 100%. But the real facts are there is no possible way at 6 years old, you know, with like my princess pony backpack, or I don't know what I rocked, a Ninja Turtle backpack, that this wasn't relatable content, right? So if I'm not listening to relatable content, then what is it that is drawing me so hypnotically, which is another Biggie song. But I haven't spoken this or quite thought of it this way out loud. It must have been the rhythmic refuge. It must have been the mathematics. It must have been the puzzle. It must have been the heartbeat, the backbone. It must have been sensing something about how this was incredibly relatable content for a vast majority of humans that were seeking like some sort of safe community in music. That's what hip hop does. And it's more elements, obviously, than the music. There's the breaking, and there's graph and art, and there's turntablism, and there's emceeing. And this whole culture that, as I said, I have borrowed from or has invited me in, because there is this welcoming if you're dope. Like if you put your 10,000 hours in, there's got to be, right, some gatekeeping. Like hip hop certainly did not get brewed up in Boulder, Colorado, or even close to it, right? And here I am in this bubble that has mostly, yeah, socioeconomic pinpoints that cannot relate to Flatbush Brooklyn, or at least the Brooklyn in the 80s and 90s. It's different now. And even it goes way, way back than all of this, you know, to jazz and to Africa. And like I could traverse, we don't have to do history right now, because I think the question was more how has it informed my spirituality? And I think just that experience of refuge, which is the same thing sometimes we're seeking with spiritual practices or with spiritual community. It's refuge. It's feeling safe. It's feeling like you belong. It's feeling stimulated. It's feeling inspired. All these things were things I found in, you know, I then gravitated more towards like the Rhymesayers label and Brother Ali, who might as well, you know, is a pastor damn near, and Atmosphere, who decided to do rap in a different way. Like, I mean, he's got a whole hard ass rap song about sunshine, you know, like about a sunny day. And I'm like, you're allowed to do that? You know, I'd been like listening to Eminem and like chop up your mom's arm stuff. And it's like, you're allowed to rap and sing about your bicycle? That's interesting. And just the pure like poetics of communicating a thought in another part of the brain than direct conversation, but still it was conversational. And beats do so. I'm a dancer first and foremost. I blew out my hamstring and stopped on that path as far as like real intense training. But dancing was always the first expression, I'd say, and then poetry. And it was all about being safe, because I'm still unsure if I've like regulated my nervous system into feeling safe all the time. That's not yet an experience I have consistently. And so I think we're drawn to a lot of things because it either it feels good and safe, or you like the high of not feeling safe. Like, I know some hardcore scenes and some metal things I've gotten into were very much playing with the energy of like, nothing is safe about this mosh pit right now. And we're going to find out and then walk out alive still. So it's like these initiations we seek that have the potential of death, like a true initiation, and you get spit out the other side and there's this very alive feeling. And that's what almost stepping in a cipher became. Of course, there's no real threat of death, but there's the threat of like stumbling on your words and being really embarrassed, you know, and your ego dying a little or whatever happens there. But when you get through and you're in a flow with people, or you know you're doing something cool or whatever's happening, and then that evening ends, there's a real high that became more nourishing to me than other types of highs I would pursue. I started using drugs at a very young age, and the only thing that's outlasted, I don't use them anymore, but the only thing that has outlasted is the spiritual practice of expression and helping others in their expression. I quite enjoy at this point coaching, or just, I don't love that word, just like making some space for people to feel safe in this inherent gift, this innate gift we got given on account of you have a vocal box, you have a heart, you have breath. And like, those are the only ingredients we really kind of technically need. Pain helps. Pain helps. And to speak to you, say, in that full spectrum in my vocal access, or different head voices and soul voices, or different voices entirely. Sometimes I've had a few sets that I'm like, who it was, you know, just, I don't want to use the word channeling, but there's definitely some other tones that I can't just reach on a normal Tuesday. And that's always super interesting, because again, I think it's the tuning of the field that does a certain sort of tuning. Or even, again, I keep mentioning Saturday night, I ended up doing kind of like some Kapalabhati, like breath work on the mic. I didn't mean to. I just had nothing to say. And I just started going, like I was doing this like breath beatbox thing. And I've never done this. I've never done this. But I felt so like combination of safe and fuck it. If they judge me, it was a combination of like, I'm playing. And also breath is the mana. Breath is the beginning of it all. And I don't actually include this in my set enough. Maybe I will. So for 5 minutes, my guitarist is going off and I'm just going, and it, you know, probably just aerated my vocal cords, frankly, to where my singing tone was so gritty and cool and had this like, yeah, guttural, the grief that I'm trying to get across. But then I can apply whatever words with this tone. You know how we all like, I don't want to say we all, but I think there's something special when you hear a singer or a Bill Withers type or a voice that like is carrying many with it, many generations or a lot of pain, or they just sound like they smoke 6 packs a day. Whatever it is, I think we're drawn to voices that sound like they crawled out of dark waters, deep waters. I think there's something really cool and fascinating that they could be saying anything And it's just the quality of the vocal texture that's so interesting. Anyways, I got off the path, but but there's something beyond my understanding with that. I'm sure there's like the technical, you know, a vocal coach could explain to us more, but there's something a little beyond it. There's something a little beyond the technicals, and that's the ghosts.
If you're enjoying the episode, please consider subscribing to our Patreon to help support the production of the podcast.
Subscriptions begin at $1. All patrons receive access to bonus content, curated resources, and exclusive patron events, including live Q&As.
For more information, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, like even on the kind of a spiritual perspective on voices, like these different layers of voice and how you can attune to different levels of the voice. Like the most kind of superficial level is paying attention to the words and to the content of what's being said. And then the next level down is what you were speaking to, like a kind of tonality of our voice. And then kind of listening into that tonality, there's almost like the kind of spirit of the voice or the soul of the voice. And there's can be almost kind of direct perception of a certain kind of vibration that is not disconnected or separate from the meaning of the words or the tonality, but is kind of undergirding it. And I think we underestimate how much it's kind of those three things that are creating the totality of the impact of someone's voice. And I think that's more clear in vocal performance, but we tend to be so hyper-focused on content. And I think it's interesting in hip hop where you have songs that are maybe so fast or so complex that upon first listen, you're not even really able to wrap your head around all the nuance of meaning. And yet there's this intense attraction to it because it's like, oh, I like the way that feels. Mm. And I think that's the more general sense, more than like, I like the meaning of those lyrics. I like the way that feels in my body, yeah. The rhythm of it and all of that. So that's what it brought up for me.
I think there's something too that you were speaking to about the subversive nature of art. I always say about spirituality that spirituality is inherently subversive. And if it's not subversive, it's not spirituality. It needs to be undermining the strategies of the ego, including the ones that get kind of caricatured as spirituality, the shanti, shanti, shanti. You know, it's like spirituality is not that. That's just somebody's prepackaged version of spirituality to make you feel better about your shitty life.
Yo, yes. Yeah, feeling states.
Yeah. And so spirituality should be even undermining that vision. Like, it's not all sweetness. Yeah, like spirituality is in the pain and the dark too. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's spirituality and there's spirituality. And there's art and there's art. Huh. And if we go to art, the real thing is inherently subverting the ego. Because if you're an artist and you're really paying attention, you're onto the art, you'll know you're not making it all the time. And you become a kind of vessel for something special. And so for me, if you're aware of that, that's not different than spiritual process. Like, why did you go into the thing that worked? You know, and fuck it, I don't know why I'm doing it, but I'm doing it and it works. And then it led to the opening of something else. Now, maybe there's a technology behind why that worked, but why did you do it? You know, it's like we tune ourselves first to becoming a vessel for something else, a flow that comes through us. And if we're paying attention, it's like the ego can grab on to like, yeah, I crafted a great line. But a real artist knows I didn't craft that line. It came, you know, some we craft, some we don't. And so there's something really special about that. And I don't know if you had this experience, but I know I've given some talks which were darn near perfect and they were never recorded and there was no effort. And there's a kind of beauty to that fact that it was never recorded. Like, so I can't latch on to that. I know it happened, but I can't claim it and like put it on a shelf like a trophy. Yeah, there's no evidence. Mm-hmm. And if I was really honest about it, I didn't like craft it into a beautiful thing. It was beauty. So I'm not sure that there's any difference whether it's supposed to be a spiritual thing or an artistic thing. At the core of that, They're self-purifying. There's something about it. Your ego can like co-opt anything.
Yep.
But if you're really aware, you're really honest, did we do it? We did some of it.
Yes.
But it's like the poetry that comes through and the poetry you find later. The stuff that comes through is always better, you know.
We showed up. And a confluence of it all. We have the technology of intelligence, you know, and we've coded some patterns, or we've pursued some studies that have wired us in certain ways, or we have different cravings and aversions that have wired us in certain ways. And then there's the practice of making space so all these things can meet. And like, I'm not foolish enough to say that I still don't every time participate with the judge. Like the judge is still at the table, or the, you know, the ego is definitely still sitting down to most of my writing. So I don't do much writing sessions anymore because the freestyle thing has just so taken charge. But I remember the first time I really found the meeting grounds, that first half decade, lots of writing, lots of memorizing, lots of control, lots of delivery, lots of trying to prove something, lots of trying to gain something. I want affection. I want approval. I want to do it right. You know, like, that's okay. That's what I've been healing from age 2 years old. I got asked to do a TED Talk off the coast of Seattle, and it was so last minute. They asked me like maybe 2 days before. I got an email from this wonderful woman, Gretchen. She said, I'm curating a TED Talk. Do you want to speak out? I was like, yeah, when is it? My season's pretty, but like whatever. She's like, it's tomorrow, you know, like it's in 2 days. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? I thought like people get time to prepare for these. And in a way, looking back, again, this is something I have not thought about or spoke about. I think this was a really mischievous move on Spirit's part. I think this was the coolest thing ever. And it invited me into this first dance of self-trust, and that I've been doing this long enough or whatever, that there's something there in my assignment. Because sure enough, I was like, well, okay. You know, there's a ton of me that's scared and feels completely out of control and unprepared. And I don't like how I'm feeling here. And there was just enough more feeling of curiosity, just enough more of trust and curiosity and playfulness and ego, and enough drop of ego being like, we got this. We know, you know, we've done it, whatever. So I fly to Seattle, and I take a barge out to the Orcas Island, which is, that was all powerful too, because I was dense in my journey with Lyme disease and some different autoimmune struggles and like a lot of pain. I wasn't walking well, my joints. So that was another thing of just like physically getting places. And the fact that I really pushed my physical body to get off this boat, and I'm on this island that's so lush. They say it's connected to the Hawaiian island chain, or at least like energetically same Lumerian rooted crystal potential vibes. And I felt it. I felt it was like Fern Gully vibes, like so hydrated and so mystical. And like the whole forest was having the original cipher, like the way the birds and the whole ecosystem was in a song was just really special, because I'd flown from Colorado and the dryness. Anyways, I get there. We have a dress rehearsal day, and then it's the TED Talks the next day. And this whole time, I'm like, what the fuck? What am I going to say? Why am I here? You know, a little pinch of imposter stuff, but mostly just the question mark. And I decided, okay, well, don't panic. You have some spoken word pieces, and you got some things. And I decided to combine freestyle talking and really give myself permission for the first time to just talk my way through a few landmarks. Like you said, the stories, you know, you're going to share, or the memorized pieces. So I didn't write anything down and I didn't plan, but I knew I picked a few of the pieces that on my heart felt the truest to share. And then I weaved my way around why that all made sense as a condensed 12-minute thing. And I remember in the moments of it all, right? Because you have the omniscient part of you that kind of like zooms out and disassociates and is watching the whole thing. Then you have your physical vessel that's doing the thing. And then you have the judge, and then you have the fun little innocent, like there's all these, I don't know, it might be just borderline personality. It might be just, who knows how much we fracture in a good way. But I do recall one part of me tracking like, hey, this is cool. This is going all right. Especially because it was an audience that I'd never, like, back to that conversation of having your preferred type of audience or not. This was not a pop culture audience. I think I was the youngest in the whole, not arena, lecture hall, you know, by 30, 40 years. And they were like tough cookies to crack. But once that, yeah, that might've been my first time of feeling like, ooh, we all got on a vibe together and I get to take them wherever I want then. And then they trust me a little, or at least they're curious too. And then we can, and that's spirituality for me, being in curiosity together, being in an inquiry that we may never get like the for sure answer for. We don't get to know, but we get to be in prayer. We get to ask questions. We get to listen to great question askers that have come before us, you know, and keep it real. Like you said, Daniel, I didn't get to touch on the keep it realness, but for me, I don't know really what keeping it real is besides saying, I don't know. Yeah. I think there's been many times I haven't kept it as real as either I'd like to, or just it didn't feel safe, you know, back to that safety thing. I think realness also is subjective. Like there's so many ways you can take that. I do know that I just fractured my foot, and on that foot, it had a K-I-R, which stands for keep it real. And the K is a tree. It's like a tree branch that makes a K. And the I is a fire burst. And the R is a wave, a lowercase r wave. And so realness, K-I-R, and why they're elementals is because that's the realest thing to me is Earth's teachings and change and seasonal shifts in us all. So like keeping it real means accepting participation in your own evolution. And I'm like finding myself more and more, but I used to fake the funk a little bit, like, cause just doing a full, just hip hop, that's that set is not true to me. It's not as real. I am now inviting these prayers. I grew up in an ashram, you know, like recircling back to my roots of like, yeah, kirtan raised me a little bit. And how can you just be all your parts, not just to fit into one thing, making, again, back to making space, which is such also a weird phrase we use too much. It's I'm going to hold space. And like, what is that? What, how? But making more of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm super glad you touched on the TED Talk because I'd like to plug that. We'll put that in the show notes for people to check out.
It's also nice and awkward, y'all. Check it out. But I watch it back and I, as much as I share that was like an epiphanous experience, it's so cringe.
No. This is like every artist ever who like looks back at their work and is like, so oh, it was all cringe. Terrible. From the outside perspective, it was not cringe at all. It was dope.
I'm so glad. Yeah. That's Baby Lily. Check out the beginning.
I like the, you know, the most keeping it real thing you can say is, I don't know. And the thing that we're afraid to say all the time, we've been talking about vulnerability, you know, the biggest, you know, the most profound thing about spirituality is standing before the mystery together, you know, and acknowledging it and that we're on a journey and heading in that direction, but we don't know. We don't know, but we can hold hands and walk together and, you know, be in and experience together before that mystery. Then you can be on the edge of your life. Mm. There's a Zen text, you know, that I'm always talking about called The Sword of No Sword. And it was written by a Zen master for a sword master. And he's trying to tell him, you know, that when it comes to the sword contest, don't think about swords. Don't think about what you're going to do. Don't think about anything. You know, you need to be in the state of no mind. Mm. And this was coming back up as you were talking. I was thinking, an artist has to train, just like a sword master has to train. You have to practice the moves, and there are things to do, and there are muscles to condition. All of that has to happen so that in the moment when you need to use it, you don't think about any of those things. Mm-hmm. It's muscle memory, you know, and that's what the Zen master is trying to get through to him. Don't think, you know, let yourself be. Now, you've conditioned yourself into being a certain kind of vessel. Now let the vessel operate. Don't try to like try to make something happen anymore. Now just be available. Be a sword. Be a flute. You know, this is the Sufi metaphor. that we're all cut from the reed bed, and the great craftsman bores little holes into us. That's the pain we experience in life. But we're crafted to be a flute through which the divine can blow, you know, the perfect note. And the song of our souls, the song that comes through us, is the song of remembering the reed bed where we were all connected and felt most alive, you know. But it's like we're being crafted into something that can make a note for the world, not necessarily for ourselves. So it's like there is this relationship between the training.
Boom. But it is through us first.
Yeah.
Often some of these conversations really go towards, yeah, it's bigger than us. It's for this. But I want to note the selfishness of me returning to this craft over and over because it's my therapy first, or it's my feeling aliveness first. And like a meta practice has to move through you. You have to be really with you before you're sending it out. And mm-hmm. sometimes I'm on that and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I shouldn't be sending out a little lighthouse. Or it's all fine, again, because when I'm sending out a lighthouse from a vibration that is maybe not calibrated to the highest yet, I'm attracting some really wounded people. And that's fine, too, because then they're on the journey with me and then we go where we can go. And they're welcomed. I have had to learn like different skills to not take it in too deep or too close, which is hard for me with some of the content types of topics I've talked about. I get a lot of people in a lot of pain, with a lot of holes in the flute, with a lot of like, you know, God's carved quite a bit out. But that I got chills when you said that because some of the more complex notes are able to be played and explored with people who have traversed down there. And oh yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge my selfishness in first sometimes the writing or the freestyling processes to be very much just to meet the moment of my own mental health or where I'm at and just as a saving grace or an anchor, but whatever it is for me to keep going, you know, just to keep going because we do live in more isolated times as far as spiritual community. It's like, yeah, we're connecting and yeah, I can tap in or meet up, but it's not the way it used to be for our systems. And our nervous systems, I think, are quite confused with the lack of connection and co-regulation. And so one way we can co-regulate together is in art that resonates, you know, or my favorite writer and beat producer right now is named Deca, D-E-C-A. And that's someone who's brought together all the pieces you were saying, Daniel, like sometimes it's just the voice tone and vibrational essence, but then when they can do the words too, or the beat too, like when it's all, they hit all the marks at the same time. Sometimes you get 2 out of 4 or 1 out of 4 or 3 out of 4, but he's 4 out of 4 for me. And it hits like a refuge I haven't found in years is what his work's been for me. And also just the relatability, like he was a former heroin user. He comes from Colorado and moved to New York. I'm from New York and moved to Colorado. So we kind of like passed. We've never met. We're going to play a show in the fall of 2023 together for the first time. But that feeling, not aloneness, like when you relate to someone's content or speeches or art or that that is something super sacred, to find a feeling of I'm not alone. And that's meeting the mystery together. And that's what spirituality can do, is say, hey, we are alone together. Mm-hmm. You know, like you may be born alone, maybe die alone, but never actually. I don't know, that work I did and still do, I've taken a break, but as a end of life care, like death doula, taught me a lot about further I don't know-ness, but also the not aloneness in these times of thin veil. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, we might be born alone and die alone, but in terms of living and vitality, we don't live alone. We're bouncing off each other. Like you say, the joy in music or reading art is that we feel seen and heard, and we see ourselves reflected in other people's work. I think that's that thing where you're saying, you know, some of this I do for me. I think that's the magic of vocation. Mm. Like when you hit your vocation, it meets a need that meets your need and somebody else's. Mm. And that's the perfect magic that we're looking for. that meets my need and it serves somehow so that my verse in the universe is vibrating in a way that somebody feels recognized.
So Natano, those are bars, yeah. Verse and universe.
Verse in the universe.
It's my little contribution.
It made me think of Howard Thurman, who we had this whole appreciation for last episode. And Howard Thurman says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is people who are alive. And so I just think in that sense of what you were speaking to, Lily, sometimes there's the selfish motive or whatever, how maybe there's that connection between selfishness and the collective. But just to bring us into a close here, because we are kind of getting to the end of our time. First, I just wanted to ask you, Lily, do you have anything that you want to plug, any projects that you're excited about that you want to let people know about?
I really just want to tell y'all to go listen to DECA, which that's not good self-promotion. Oh, gosh. I just want to thank you guys again for this. You can follow me. It's Lily, LILYFANGZ. I'm sure we'll have it written somewhere. It's Lily Fangs on all the platforms. And just being connected on socials has been cool. That's been a lot of attention for me. That's a whole other podcast, again, like the spirituality of social media or lack thereof, but a way of feeling interconnected and the web, the World Wide Web. But feel free to get in touch there. I also have recently launched a little writers collective, which is more focusing on grief alchemy, particularly called the Phoenix Studies, which is self-study on your Phoenix cycles, which if I haven't been clear in this talk, I am really down for the constant death and rebirth. And so that is available in kind of one-on-one format with me or a cohort of people. And I'm looking to make it as accessible as possible, sliding scale, financial. So send a message as well for that. I'll make it more visible. That's my job, is to make things available and like easy to find online. But I'm not good at doing all the things. I have many, many hats. I have all these hats hanging on my wall, but I just wear this big one.
It's an awesome hat for everybody that can't see.
It's a good hat if you can't see it. I do have an album, drop it. I'm going to upload all my old songs and stuff to Spotify. I guess it's a good place to be listening. But album called Mosaic. Coming soon. I've been saying that for quite a while, but things aren't ready till they're ready, you know. And Mosaic will be a little piece of everything, just as they are, but like accepting ourselves as multi-inquiry, multi-genre, multi-flavor spectrum beings. So I'm excited for that whenever it happens.
Well, people will keep listening to this this episode for a long time, so hopefully it'll just hit right in the moment for a lot of people.
Hey, perfect. Yeah, maybe 2029 and it's still not anywhere to be found. But
so we want to thank you for being here, Lily. It's really been amazing to just have this kind of conversation that really connects all the things that we're doing. You know, we think we're in these separate, you know, spheres, but we're all humans and there's a place where they all meet. And I think we've been talking in that place. We have a kind of tradition on the show where we kind of go out with a poem or prayer or an offering of some sort. And I don't know if you came with anything, but we're open for it.
Ooh, we're open. We could do the open experiment of what's here now. Or there's a poem I usually begin my sets with, but this would be cool to close. Let's see. So big breath, everyone who's listening, and an exhale. Our hearts are knocking at our rib cage again. The doors are opening and they sending us in. There's soul work to do on this here plane. Seems to be whole hurt for you, don't dismiss this pain. Discomfort is where the neurons of my being bow down. Discomfort is where I've learned how to carve my own crown. It takes raw flesh and tooth, old soul and roots. So let us choose something. Let us step into the truth. We can all decide. Are we gonna take this ride? We got what we need and some wisdom by our side. Because it's about an hour past the age of Aquarius, and I know the fears are various, but very much we must muster up the strength to grow. And from the bottom of our roots, we could soak up the nutrients slow until the ink of the blueprints glow and we redefine a paradigm where we can all go. We stop dividing up. Oh, because when the winds of change blow, it might be a tornado. They've been whispering change for far too long. We're all here to improve, right? Walk in a few pairs of shoes, right? Learn lessons about the soul. It doesn't break. It doesn't bruise, right? May feel like it is, but similar to a bone, it just gets stronger. I feel like I've been hanging on a jungle gym, not sure if I can keep my grip any longer. So I'll drop. Trust that the net will appear. Our reflexes are on point, so it's not the fall we should fear. Yeah, yeah, my third eye's open, but I keep catching its tear. Ooh, so here is where we stand up for what we mean by community. Here is where we stand up for free speech and unity. Here we learn the language of each other's hearts until we speak it fluently. So that's the prayer. May we speak the language of each other's hearts fluently.
Amen. Amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, cyborg robots who help us make this happen. And thank you, everyone tuning in whatever moment you're tuning in.
Shout out to friend of the show, Tree Fort of Golden Turtle Sound, for producing the intro and outro music and assisting with mixing and mastering. Be sure to check out his awesome music and hit up Golden Turtle Sound for any of your audio engineering needs.